Chapter 1. I'm 7 years old, talking to myself, because I'm scared, and because I'm the only person who listens to me. Under my breath, I whisper, "Just quit, Andre. Just give up. Put down your racket and walk off this court right now. Go into the house and get something good to eat. Play with Rita, Philly, or Tammy. Sit with Mom while she knits or does her jigsaw puzzle. Doesn't that sound nice? Wouldn't that feel like heaven, Andre? To just quit? To never play tennis again?" But I can't. Not only would my father chase me around the house with my racket, but something in my gut, some deep unseen muscle, won't let me. I hate tennis, hate it with all my heart, and still I keep playing, keep hitting all morning and all afternoon, because I have no choice. No matter how much I want to stop, I don't. I keep begging myself to stop, and I keep playing, and this gap, this contradiction between what I want to do and what I actually do, feels like the core of my life. At the moment, my hatred for tennis is focused on the dragon, a ball machine modified by my fire-belching father. Midnight black, set on big rubber wheels, the word Prince painted in white block letters along its base. The dragon looks at first glance like the ball machine at every country club in America, but it's actually a living, breathing creature straight out of my comic books. The dragon has a brain, a will, a black heart, and a horrifying voice. Sucking another ball into its belly, the dragon makes a series of sickening sounds. As pressure builds inside its throat, it groans. As the ball rises slowly to its mouth, it shrieks. For a moment, the dragon sounds almost silly, like the fudge machine swallowing Augustus Gloop in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. But when the dragon takes dead aim at me and fires a ball 110 miles an hour, the sound it makes is a blood-curdling roar. I flinch every time. My father has deliberately made the dragon fearsome. He's given it an extra-long neck of aluminum tubing and a narrow aluminum head which recoils like a whip every time the dragon fires. He's also set the dragon on a base several feet high and moved it flush against the net, so the dragon towers above me. At 7 years old, I'm small for my age. I look smaller because of my constant wince and the bi-monthly bowl haircuts my father gives me. But when standing before the dragon, I look tiny, feel tiny, helpless. My father wants the dragon to tower over me, not simply because it commands my attention and respect. He wants the balls that shoot from the dragon's mouth to land at my feet as if dropped from an airplane. The trajectory makes the balls nearly impossible to return in a conventional way. I need to hit every ball on the rise, or else it will bounce over my head. But even that's not enough for my father. "Hit earlier," he yells. "Hit earlier." My father yells everything twice, sometimes 3 times, sometimes 10. "Harder," he says. "Harder." But what's the use? No matter how hard I hit a ball, no matter how early, the ball comes back. Every ball I send across the net joins the thousands that already cover the court. Not hundreds, thousands. They roll toward me in perpetual waves. I have no room to turn, to step, to pivot. I can't move without stepping on a ball. And yet, I can't step on a ball, because my father won't bear it. Step on one of my father's tennis balls, and he'll howl as if you stepped on his eyeball. Every third ball fired by the dragon hits a ball already on the ground, causing a crazy sideways hop. I adjust at the last second, catch the ball early, and hit it smartly across the net. I know this is no ordinary reflex. I know there are few children in the world who could have seen that ball, let alone hit it. But I take no pride in my reflexes, and I get no credit. It's what I'm supposed to do. Every hit is expected, every miss a crisis. My father says that if I hit 2,500 balls each day, I'll hit 17,500 balls each week, and at the end of 1 year, I'll have hit nearly 1,000,000 balls. He believes in math. Numbers, he says, don't lie. A child who hits 1,000,000 balls each year will be unbeatable. Hit earlier, my father yells. Damn it, Andre, hit earlier. Crowd the ball. Crowd the ball. Now he's crowding me. He's yelling directly into my ear. It's not enough to hit everything the dragon fires at me. My father wants me to hit it harder and faster than the dragon. He wants me to beat the dragon. The thought makes me panicky. I tell myself, you can't beat the dragon. How can you beat something that never stops? Come to think of it, the dragon is a lot like my father, except my father is worse. At least the dragon stands before me where I can see it. My father stays behind me. I rarely see him, only hear him, day and night, yelling in my ear. More topspin. Hit harder. Hit harder. Not in the net. Damn it, Andre. Never in the net. Nothing sends my father into a rage like hitting a ball into the net. He dislikes when I hit the ball wide. He yells when I hit a ball long. But when I muff a ball into the net, he foams at the mouth. Errors are one thing. The net is something else. Over and over, my father says, the net is your biggest enemy. My father has raised the enemy 6 inches higher than regulation to make it that much harder to avoid. If I can clear my father's high net, he figures I'll have no trouble clearing the net one day at Wimbledon. Never mind that I don't want to play Wimbledon. What I want isn't relevant. Sometimes I watch Wimbledon on TV with my father, and we both root for Bjorn Borg. Because he's the best, he never stops, he's the nearest thing to the dragon. But I don't want to be Borg. I admire his talent, his energy, his style, his ability to lose himself in his game. But if I ever develop those qualities, I'd rather apply them to something other than Wimbledon, something of my own choosing. Hit harder, my father yells. Hit harder! Now backhands. Backhands! My arm feels like it's going to fall off. I want to ask, how much longer, Pops? But I don't ask. I do as I'm told. I hit as hard as I can, then slightly harder. On one swing, I surprise myself by how hard I hit, how cleanly. Though I hate tennis, I like the feeling of hitting a ball dead perfect. It's the only piece. When I do something perfect, I enjoy a split second of sanity and calm. The dragon responds to perfection, however, by firing the next ball faster. Short backswing, my father says. Short back, that's it. Brush the ball. Brush the ball. At the dinner table, my father will sometimes demonstrate. Drop your racket under the ball, he says. And brush, brush. He makes a motion like a painter, gently wafting a brush. This might be the only thing I've ever seen my father do gently. Work your volleys, he yells, or tries to. An Armenian, born in Iran, my father speaks 5 languages, none of them well, and his English is heavily accented. He mixes his V's and W's, so it sounds like this. Work your volleys. Of all his instructions, this is his favorite. He yells this until I hear it in my dreams. Work your volleys. Work your volleys. I've worked so many volleys I can no longer see the court. Not one patch of green cement is visible beneath the yellow balls. I slide-step, shuffling like an old man. Finally, even my father has to admit there are too many balls. It's counterproductive. If I can't move, we won't make our daily quota of 2,500. He revs up the blower, the giant machine for drying the court after it rains. Of course, it never rains where we live, Las Vegas, Nevada. So my father uses the blower to corral tennis balls. Just as he did with the ball machine, my father has modified a standard blower, made it into another demonic creature. It's one of my earliest memories, 5 years old, getting pulled out of kindergarten, going with my father to the welding shop, and watching him build this insane lawnmower-like machine that can move hundreds of tennis balls at once. Now I watch him push the blower, watch the tennis balls scurry from him, and feel sympathy for the balls. If the dragon and the blower are living things, maybe the balls are too. Maybe they're doing what I would if I could, running from my father. After blowing all the balls into one corner, my father takes a snow shovel and scoops the balls into a row of metal garbage cans, slop buckets with which he feeds the dragon. He turns, sees me watching.
"What the hell are you looking at? Keep hitting. Keep hitting."
My shoulder aches. I can't hit another ball. I hit another 3. I can't go on another minute. I go another 10. I get an idea. Accidentally, on purpose, I hit a ball high over the fence. I manage to catch it on the wooden rim of the racket, so it sounds like a misfire. I do this when I need a break, and it crosses my mind that I must be pretty good if I can hit a ball wrong at will. My father hears the ball hit wood and looks up. He sees the ball leave the court. He curses. But he heard the ball hit wood, so he knows it was an accident. Besides, at least I didn't hit the net. He stomps out of the yard, out to the desert. I now have 4.5 minutes to catch my breath and watch the hawks circling lazily overhead. My father likes to shoot the hawks with his rifle. Our house is blanketed with his victims, dead birds that cover the roof as thickly as tennis balls cover the court. My father says he doesn't like hawks because they swoop down on mice and other defenseless desert creatures. He can't stand the thought of something strong preying on something weak. This also holds true when he goes fishing. Whatever he catches, he kisses its scaly head and throws it back. Of course, he has no qualms about preying on me, no trouble watching me gasp for air on his hook. He doesn't see the contradiction. He doesn't care about contradictions. He doesn't realize that I'm the most defenseless creature in this godforsaken desert. If he did realize, I wonder, would he treat me differently? He now stomps back onto the court, slams the ball into a garbage can, and sees me staring at the hawks. He glares.
"What the fuck are you doing? Stop thinking. No fucking thinking."
The net is the biggest enemy, but thinking is the cardinal sin. Thinking, my father believes, is the source of all bad things, because thinking is the opposite of doing. When my father catches me thinking, daydreaming, on the tennis court, he reacts as if he caught me taking money from his wallet. I often think about how I can stop thinking. I wonder if my father yells at me to stop thinking because he knows I'm a thinker by nature. Or, with all his yelling, has he turned me into a thinker? Is my thinking about things other than tennis an act of defiance? I like to think so. Our house is an overgrown shack, built in the 1970s, white stucco with peeling dark trim around its edges. The windows have bars. The roof, under all the dead hawks, has wood shingles, many of which are loose or missing. The door has a cowbell that rings every time someone comes or goes, like the opening bell of a boxing match. My father has painted the high cement wall around the house a bright forest green. Why? Because green is the color of a tennis court. Also, my father likes the convenience of directing someone to the house like this.
"Turn left, go down half a block, then look for the bright green wall."
Not that we ever have any visitors. Surrounding the house on all sides is desert, and more desert, which to me is another word for death. Dotted with sticker bushes, tumbleweed, and coiled rattlers, The desert around our house seems to have no reason for existence, other than providing a place for people to dump things they no longer want. Mattresses, tires, other people. Vegas, the casinos, the hotels, the strip, stands off in the distance, a glittering illusion. My father commutes to the illusion every day. He's a captain at one of the casinos, but he refuses to live closer. We moved out here to the middle of nowhere, the heart of nothingness, because it's only here that my father could afford a house with a yard big enough for his ideal tennis court. It's another early memory, driving around Vegas with my father and the real estate agent. It would have been funny if it hadn't been scary. At house after house, even before the agent's car came to a full stop, my father would jump out and march up the front walk. The agent, close on my father's heels, would be yakking about local schools, crime rates, interest rates, but my father wouldn't be listening. Staring straight ahead, my father would storm into the house, through the living room, through the kitchen, into the backyard, where he'd whip out his tape measure and count off 36 feet by 78 feet, the dimensions of a tennis court. Time after time, he'd yell, "Doesn't fit. Come on, let's go." My father would then march back through the kitchen, through the living room, down the front walk, the real estate agent struggling to keep pace. We saw one house my older sister Tammy desperately wanted. She begged my father to buy it, because it was shaped like a T, and T stood for Tammy. My father almost bought it, probably because T also stood for tennis. I liked the house, so did my mother. The backyard, however, was inches too short.
"Doesn't fit. Let's go."
Finally, we saw this house, its backyard so big that my father didn't need to measure. He just stood in the middle of the yard, turning slowly, gazing, grinning, seeing the future.
"Sold," he said quietly.
We hadn't carried in the last cardboard box before my father began to build his dream court. I still don't know how he did it. He never worked a day in construction. He knew nothing about concrete, asphalt, water drainage. He read no books, consulted no experts. He just got a picture in his head and set about making that picture a reality. As with so many things, he willed the court into being through sheer orneriness and energy. I think he might be doing something similar with me. He needed help, of course. Pouring concrete is a big job. So each morning, he'd drive me to Sambo's, a diner on the strip, where we'd recruit a few old-timers from the gang that hung out in the parking lot. My favorite was Rudy. Battle-scarred, barrel-chested, Rudy always looked at me with a half-smile, as if he understood that I didn't know who or where I was. Rudy and his gang would follow me and my father back to our house, and there my father would tell them what he needed doing. After 3 hours, my father and I would run down to McDonald's and buy huge sacks of Big Macs and French fries. When we returned, my father would let me ring the cowbell and call the men to lunch. I loved rewarding Rudy. I loved watching him eat like a wolf. I loved the concept of hard work leading to sweet rewards, except when hard work meant hitting tennis balls. The days of Rudy and the Big Macs passed in a blur. Suddenly, my father had his backyard tennis court, which meant I had my prison. I'd helped feed the chain gang that built my cell. I'd helped measure and paint the white lines that would confine me. Why did I do it? I had no choice. The reason I do everything. No one ever asked me if I wanted to play tennis, let alone make it my life. In fact, my mother thought I was born to be a preacher. She tells me, however, that my father decided long before I was born that I would be a professional tennis player. When I was 1 year old, she adds, I proved my father right. Watching a ping-pong game, I moved only my eyes, never my head. My father called to my mother.
"Look,"
he said.
See how he moves only his eyes? Unnatural.
She tells me that when I was still in the crib, my father hung a mobile of tennis balls above my head and encouraged me to slap at them with a ping-pong paddle he'd taped to my hand. When I was 3, he gave me a sawed-off racket and told me to hit whatever I wanted. I specialized in salt shakers. I liked serving them through glass windows. I aced the dog. My father never got mad. He got mad about many things, but never about hitting something hard with a racket. When I was 4, he had me hitting with tennis greats who passed through town, beginning with Jimmy Connors. My father told me that Connors was one of the finest to ever play. I was more impressed that Connors had a bowl haircut just like mine. When we finished hitting, Connors told my father that I was sure to become very good.
I already know that, my father said, annoyed. Very good? He's going to be number 1 in the world.
He wasn't seeking Connors's confirmation. He was seeking someone who could give me a game. Whenever Connors comes to Vegas, my father strings his rackets. My father is a master stringer. Who better than my old man to create and maintain tension? It's always the same drill. In the morning, Connors gives my father a box of rackets, and 8 hours later, my father and I meet Connors at a restaurant on the Strip. My father sends me in, cradling the restrung rackets. I ask the manager if he can point me to Mr. Connors's table. The manager sends me to a far corner where Connors sits with his entourage. Connors is at the center, back to the wall. I hold his rackets toward him, carefully, not saying a word. The conversation at the table comes to a halt, and everyone looks down at me. Connors takes the rackets roughly and sets them on a chair. For a moment, I feel important, as though I've delivered freshly sharpened swords to one of the 3 musketeers. Then Connors tousles my hair, says something sarcastic about me or my father, and everyone at the table guffaws. The better I get at tennis, the worse I get at school, which pains me. I like books, but I feel overmatched by them. I like my teachers, but don't understand much of what they say. I don't seem to learn or process facts the way other kids do. I have a steel trap memory, but trouble concentrating. I need things explained twice, 3 times. Maybe that's why my father yells everything twice. Also, I know that my father resents every moment I spend in school. It comes at the cost of court time. Disliking school, therefore, doing poorly in school, feels like loyalty to Pops. Some days, when he's driving me and my siblings to school, my father will smile and say,
I'll make you guys a deal. Instead of taking you to school, how about I take you to Cambridge Racquet Club? You can hit balls all morning. How does that sound?
We know what he wants us to say, so we say it.
Hooray! Just don't tell your mother, my father says.
Cambridge Racquet Club is a long, low-roofed dump, just east of the Strip, with 10 hard courts and a seedy smell. Dust, sweat, liniment, plus something sour, something just past its expiration date, that I can never quite identify. My father treats Cambridge like an addition to our house. He stands with the owner, Mr. Fong, and they watch us closely, making sure we play, that we don't waste our time talking or laughing. Eventually, my father lets out a short whistle, a sound I'd know anywhere. He puts his fingers in his mouth, gives 1 hard blast, and that means game, set, match. Stop hitting and get in the car now. My siblings always stop before I do. Rita, the oldest, Philly, my older brother, and Tammy, they all play tennis well. We're like the Von Trapps of tennis. But me, the youngest, the baby, I'm the best. My father tells me so, tells my siblings, tells Mr. Fong. Andre is the chosen one. That's why my father gives me most of his attention. I'm the last best hope of the Agassi clan. Sometimes I like the extra attention from my father. Sometimes I'd rather be invisible, because my father can be scary. My father does things. For instance, he often reaches a thumb and forefinger inside his nostril and, bracing himself for the eye-watering pain, pulls out a thick bouquet of black nose hairs. This is how he grooms himself. In the same spirit, he shaves his face without soap or cream. He simply runs a disposable razor up and down his dry cheeks and jaw, shredding his skin, then letting the blood trickle down his face until it dries. When stressed, when distracted, my father often stares off into space and mumbles,
"I love you, Margaret."
I ask my mother one day, "Who's Pops talking to? Who's Margaret?" My mother says that when my father was my age, he was skating on a pond and the ice cracked. He fell through and drowned, stopped breathing for a long time. He was pulled from the water and revived by a woman named Margaret. He'd never seen her before and never saw her again. But every so often he sees her in his mind and speaks to her and thanks her in his most tender voice. He says this vision of Margaret comes upon him like a seizure. He has no knowledge while it's happening and only a dim memory afterward. Violent by nature, my father is forever preparing for battle. He shadow boxes constantly. He keeps an axe handle in his car. He leaves the house with a handful of salt and pepper in each pocket in case he's in a street fight and needs to blind someone. Of course, some of his most vicious battles are with himself. He has chronic stiffness in his neck, and he's perpetually loosening the neck bones by angrily twisting and yanking his head. When this doesn't work, he shakes himself like a dog, whipping his head from side to side until the neck makes a sound like popcorn popping. When even this doesn't work, he resorts to the heavy punching bag that hangs from a harness outside our house. My father stands on a chair, removes the punching bag, and places his neck in the harness. He then kicks away the chair and drops a foot through the air, his momentum abruptly halted by the harness. The first time I saw him do this, I was walking through the rooms of the house. I looked up, and there was my father kicking the chair, hanging by his neck, his shoes 3 feet off the ground. I had no doubt he'd killed himself. I ran to him, hysterical. Seeing the stricken look on my face, he barked,
"What the fuck is the matter with you?"
Most of his battles, however, are against others, and they typically begin without warning, at the most unexpected times. In his sleep, for instance. He boxes in his dreams, and frequently hauls off and punches my dozing mother. In the car, too. My father enjoys few things more than driving his green diesel Oldsmobile, singing along to his 8-track of Laura Branigan. But if another driver crosses him, if another driver cuts him off, or objects to being cut off by my father, everything goes dark. I'm driving with my father one day, going to Cambridge, and he gets into a shouting match with another driver. My father stops his car, steps out, orders the man out of his. Because my father is wielding his axe handle, the man refuses. My father whips the axe handle into the man's headlights and taillights, sending sprays of glass everywhere. Another time, my father reaches across me and points his handgun at another driver. He holds the gun level with my nose. I stare straight ahead. I don't move. I don't know what the other driver has done wrong, only that it's the automotive equivalent of hitting into the net. I feel my father's finger tensing on the trigger. Then I hear the other driver speed away, followed by a sound I rarely hear, my father laughing. He's busting a gut. I tell myself that I'll remember this moment, my father laughing, holding a gun under my nose, if I live to be 100. When he puts the gun back into the glove box and throws the car into drive, my father turns to me.
"Don't tell your mother," he says.
I can't imagine why he says this. What would my mother do if we told her? She never raises a word of protest. Does my father think there's a first time for everything? On a rare, rainy day in Vegas, my father is driving me to pick up my mother at her office. I'm standing on my end of the bench seat, horsing around, singing. My father gets in the left lane to make a turn. A trucker honks at my father. My father apparently forgot to signal. My father gives the trucker the finger. His hand flies up so fast it nearly hits my face. The trucker yells something. My father lets fly a stream of curses. The trucker stops, opens his door. My father stops, jumps out. I crawl into the back seat and watch through the back window. The rain is falling harder. My father approaches the trucker. The trucker throws a punch. My father ducks, deflects the punch with the top of his head, then throws a blazingly fast combination, ending with an uppercut. The trucker is lying on the pavement. He's dead. I'm sure of it. If he's not dead, he soon will be, because he's in the middle of the road and someone will run him over. My father gets back in the car and we peel away. I stay in the back seat, watching the trucker through the back window, rain pelting his unconscious face. I turn to see my father mumbling, throwing combinations against the steering wheel. Just before we pick up my mother, he looks down at his hands, clenches and unclenches his fists to make sure the knuckles aren't broken. Then he looks in the back seat, directly into my eyes, though it feels as if he's seeing Margaret. Somewhat tenderly, he says, "Don't tell your mother." Such moments, and many more, come to mind whenever I think about telling my father that I don't want to play tennis. Besides loving my father and wanting to please him, I don't want to upset him. I don't dare. Bad stuff happens when my father is upset. If he says I'm going to play tennis, if he says I'm going to be number one in the world, that it's my destiny, all I can do is nod and obey. I would advise Jimmy Connors or anyone else to do the same. The road to number one goes over Hoover Dam. When I'm almost 8 years old, my father says the time has come to move from backyard sessions with the Dragon and hit-arounds at Cambridge to actual tournaments against real-life little boys all over Nevada and Arizona and California. Every weekend, the whole family piles into the car and drives, either north on U.S. 95 toward Reno or south through Henderson and over Hoover Dam across the desert to Phoenix or Scottsdale or Tucson. The last place I want to be, other than a tennis court, is in a car with my father. But it's all settled. I'm condemned to divide my childhood between these two boxes. I win my first seven tournaments in the 10-and-under bracket. My father has no reaction. I'm simply doing what I'm supposed to do. Driving back over Hoover Dam, I stare at all the water bottled up behind the massive wall. I look at the inscription on the base of the flagpole, "In honor of those men who, inspired by a vision of lonely lands made fruitful." I turn this phrase over in my mind, "Lonely lands." Is there a land lonelier than our house in the desert? I think about the rage bottled up in my father, like the Colorado River inside the Hoover Dam. Only a matter of time before it bursts. Nothing to do but scramble for high ground. For me, that means winning. Always winning. We go to San Diego, Morley Field. I play a kid named Jeff Tarango, who isn't nearly on my level. But he wins the first set 6-4. I'm stunned. Scared. My father is going to kill me. I bear down, win the second set 6-0. Early in the third set, Tarango twists his ankle. I start drop-shotting him, trying to make him run on the bad ankle. But he's only faking. His ankle is fine. He comes bounding in and smashes my drop shots and wins every point. My father screams from the stands, "No more drop shots! No more drops!" But I can't help myself. I have a strategy. I'm sticking with it. We go to a tie break. It's best of nine. Back and forth we trade points until it's 4-all. Here it is, sudden death. 1 point for the whole match. I've never lost, and I can't imagine what my father's reaction will be if I do. I play as if my life hangs in the balance, which it does. Tarango must have a father like mine, because he's playing the same way. I haul off and rope a fizzing backhand cross-court. I hit it as a rally shot, but it comes off my racket bigger and hotter than I intended. It's a screaming winner, 3 feet in, but well beyond Tarango's reach. I howl in triumph. Tarango, standing in the center of the court, bows his head and seems to cry. Slowly, he walks toward the net. Now he stops. All of a sudden, he looks back at where the ball hit. He smiles.
Out,
he says. I stop.
The ball was out,
Tarango yells. This is the rule in juniors. Players act as their own linesmen. Players call balls in or out, and there is no appeal. Tarango has decided he'd rather do this than lose, and he knows there's nothing anyone can do about it. He raises his hands in victory. Now I start to cry. Bedlam breaks out in the stands, parents arguing, shouting, nearly coming to blows. It's not fair, it's not right, but it's reality. Tarango is the winner. I refuse to shake his hand. I run away into Balboa Park. When I return half an hour later, all cried out, my father is furious. Not because I disappeared, but because I didn't do what he said during the match.
Why didn't you listen to me? Why did you keep hitting drop shots?
For once, I'm not afraid of my father. No matter how angry he is with me, I'm angrier. I'm furious with Tarango, with God, with myself. Even though I feel Tarango cheated me, I shouldn't have put him in a position to cheat me. I shouldn't have let the match get that close. Because I did, I'll now have a loss on my record, forever. Nothing can ever change it. I can't endure the thought, but it's inescapable. I'm fallible, blemished, imperfect. A million balls hit against the dragon. For what? After years of hearing my father rant at my flaws, one loss has caused me to take up his rant. I've internalized my father, his impatience, his perfectionism, his rage. Until his voice doesn't just feel like my own, it is my own. I no longer need my father to torture me. From this day on, I can do it all by myself. Chapter 2. My father's mother lives with us. She's a nasty old lady from Tehran with a wart the size of a walnut on the edge of her nose. Sometimes you can't hear a word she's saying because you can't take your eyes off that wart. But it doesn't matter. She's surely saying the same nasty things she said yesterday and the day before, and probably saying them to my father. This seems to be the reason Grandma was put on Earth, to harass my father. He says she nagged him when he was a boy and often beat him. When he was extra bad, she made him wear hand-me-down girl clothes to school. That's why he learned to fight. If she's not pecking at my father, the old lady is squawking about the old country, sighing about the folks she left behind. My mother says Grandma is homesick. The first time I hear this word, I ask myself, how can you be sick about not being home? Home is where the dragon lives. Home is the place where, when you go there, you have to play tennis. If Grandma wants to go back home, I'm all for it. I'm only 8, but I'll drive her to the airport myself, because she causes more tension in a house that doesn't need one bit more. She makes my father miserable. She bosses me and my siblings around, and she engages in a strange competition with my mother. My mother tells me that when I was a baby, she walked into the kitchen and found Grandma breastfeeding me. Things have been awkward between the two women ever since. Of course, there is one good thing about Grandma living with us. She tells stories about my father about his childhood, and this sometimes gets my father reminiscing, causes him to open up. If not for my grandma, we wouldn't know much about my father's past, which was sad and lonely, and helps explain his odd behavior and boiling rage. Sort of. Oh, Grandma says with a sigh, we were poor. You can't imagine how poor. And hungry, she says, rubbing her belly. We had no food, also no running water, no electricity, and not a stick of furniture. Where did you sleep? We slept on the dirt floor, all of us in one tiny room, in an old apartment house built around a filthy courtyard. In one corner of the courtyard was a hole. That was the toilet for all the tenants. My father chimes in.
Things got better after the war, he says. Overnight, the streets were filled with British and American soldiers. I liked them.
Why did you like the soldiers?
They gave me candy and shoes.
They also gave him English. The first word my father learned from the GIs was victory. That's all they talked about, he says. Victory.
Whoa, they were big, he adds, and strong. I followed them everywhere, watching them, studying them, and one day I followed them to the place where they spent all their free time, a park in the woods with two clay tennis courts.
There were no fences around the courts, so the ball would go bouncing away every few seconds. My father would run after the ball and bring it back to the soldiers, like a puppy dog, until finally they made him their unofficial ball boy. Then they made him the official court custodian. My father says,
every day I swept and watered and combed the courts with a heavy roller. I painted the lines white. What a job that was. I had to use chalk water.
How much did they pay you?
Pay? Nothing. They gave me a tennis racket. It was a piece of junk, an old wooden thing strung with steel wire. But I loved it. I spent hours with that racket, hitting a tennis ball against a brick wall, alone.
Why alone?
No one else in Iran played tennis.
The only sport that could offer my father a steady supply of opponents was boxing. His toughness was tested first in one street fight after another, and then as a teenager, he strode into a gym and set to work learning formal boxing techniques. A natural, the trainers called him. Quick with his hands, light on his feet. And he had a grudge against the world. His rage, so hard for us to deal with, was an asset in the squared circle. He won a spot on the Iranian Olympic team, boxing in the bantamweight division, and went to the 1948 Games in London. 4 years later, he went to the Games in Helsinki. He didn't do well at either.
The judges, he grumbles. They were crooked. The whole thing was fixed, rigged. The world was very biased against Iran. But my son, he adds, maybe they will make tennis an Olympic sport once again, and my son will win a gold medal, and that will make up for it.
A little extra pressure to go with my everyday pressure. After seeing a bit of the world, after being an Olympian, my father couldn't return to that same single room with the dirt floor, so he snuck out of Iran. He doctored his passport and booked a flight under an assumed name to New York City, where he spent 16 days on Ellis Island, then took a bus to Chicago, where he Americanized his name. Emmanuel became Mike Agassi. By day, he worked as an elevator operator at one of the city's grand hotels. By night, he boxed. His coach in Chicago was Tony Zale, the fearless middleweight champ, often called the Man of Steel. Famous for his part in one of the sport's bloodiest rivalries, a three-bout saga with Rocky Graziano, Zale lauded my father, told him he had tons of raw talent, but pleaded with him to hit harder. Hit harder, Zale would scream at my father as he peppered the speed bag.
Hit harder. Every punch you throw it from the floor up.
With Zale in his corner, my father won the Chicago Golden Gloves, then earned a primetime fight at Madison Square Garden, his big break. But on fight night, my father's opponent fell ill. The promoters scrambled, trying to find a substitute. They found one, all right, a much better boxer, and a welterweight. My father agreed to the fight, but moments before the opening bell, he got the shakes. He ducked into a bathroom, crawled out the window above the toilet, then took the train back to Chicago. Sneaking out of Iran, sneaking out of the garden, my father is an escape artist, I think. But there's no escaping him. My father says that when he boxed, he always wanted to take a guy's best punch. He tells me one day on the tennis court,
"When you know that you just took the other guy's best punch, and you're still standing, and the other guy knows it, you will rip the heart right out of him. In tennis," he says, "same rule. Attack the other man's strength. If the man is a server, take away his serve. If he's a power player, overpower him. If he has a big forehand, takes pride in his forehand, go after his forehand until he hates his forehand."
My father has a special name for this contrarian strategy. He calls it putting a blister on the other guy's brain. With this strategy, this brutal philosophy, he stamps me for life. He turns me into a boxer with a tennis racket. More, since most tennis players pride themselves on their serve, my father turns me into a counterpuncher, a returner. Every once in a while, my father gets homesick, too. He especially misses his oldest brother, Isar.
"Someday," he vows, "your uncle Isar will sneak out of Iran like I did."
But first, Isar needs to sneak out his money. Iran is falling apart, my father explains. Revolution is brewing. The government is teetering. That's why they're watching everyone, making sure people don't drain their bank accounts and flee. Uncle Isar, therefore, is slowly, secretly converting his cash to jewels, which he then hides in packages he sends us in Vegas. It feels like Christmas every time a brown-wrapped box from Uncle Isar arrives. We sit on the living room floor and cut the string and tear the paper and shriek when we find, hidden under a tin of cookies or inside a fruitcake, diamonds and emeralds and rubies. Uncle Isar's packages arrive every few weeks, and then one day comes a much larger package. Uncle Isar, himself, on the doorstep, smiling down.
"You must be Andre."
"Yes."
"I'm your uncle."
He reaches out and touches my cheek. He's the mirror image of my father, but his personality is the exact opposite. My father is shrill and stern and filled with rage. Uncle Isar is soft-spoken and patient and funny. He's also a genius. He was an engineer back in Iran, so he helps me every night with my homework. Such a relief from my father's tutoring sessions. My father's way of teaching is to tell you once, then tell you a second time, then shout at you and call you an idiot for not getting it the first time. Uncle Isar tells you, then smiles and waits. If you don't understand, no problem. He tells you again, more softly. He has all the time in the world. I stare at Uncle Isar as he strolls through the rooms and hallways of our house. I follow him the way my father followed the British and American soldiers. As I grow familiar with Uncle Isar, I get to know him better. I like to hang from his shoulders and swing from his arms. He likes it, too. He likes to roughhouse, to be tackled and tickled by his nephews and nieces. Every night I hide behind the front door and jump out when Uncle Isar comes home, because it makes him laugh. His booming laughter is the opposite of the sounds that come from the dragon. One day Uncle Isar goes to the store for a few things. I count the minutes. At last, the front gate clanks open, then clanks shut, meaning I have exactly 12 seconds until Uncle Isar walks through the front door. It always takes people 12 seconds to go from the gate to the door. I crouch, count to 12, and as the door opens, I leap out.
Boo!
It's not Uncle Isar. It's my father. Startled, he yells, steps back, then shoots out his fist. Even though he only puts a fraction of his weight into it, my father's left hook hits my jaw flush and sends me flying. 1 second, I'm excited, joyful. The next, I'm sprawled on the ground. My father stands over me, scowling.
What the fuck is the matter with you? Go to your room.
I run to my room and throw myself on my bed. I lie there, shaking. I don't know how long. An hour? Three? Eventually, the door opens and I hear my father.
Grab your racket. Get on the court.
Time to face the dragon. I hit for half an hour, my head throbbing, my eyes tearing.
Hit harder,
my father says.
God damn it, hit harder! Not in the fucking net!
I turn and face my father. The next ball from the dragon I hit as hard as I can, but high over the fence. I aim for the hawks, and I don't bother pretending it's an accident. My father stares. He takes one menacing step toward me. He's going to hit me over the fence. But then he stops, calls me a bad name, and warns me to stay out of his sight. I run into the house and find my mother lying on her bed, reading a romance novel, her dogs at her feet. She loves animals, and our house is like Dr. Doolittle's waiting room. Dogs, birds, cats, lizards, and one mangy rat named Lady Butt. I grab one of the dogs and hurl it across the room, ignoring its insulted yelp, and bury my head in my mother's arm.
Why is Pop so mean?
What happened? I tell her. She strokes my hair and says my father doesn't know any better. Pa has his own ways, she says. Strange ways. We have to remember that Pa wants what's best for us, right? Part of me feels grateful for my mother's endless calm. Part of me, however, a part I don't like to acknowledge, feels betrayed by it. Calm sometimes means weak. She never steps in. She never fights back. She never throws herself between us kids and my father. She should tell him to back off, ease up. That tennis isn't life. But it's not in her nature. My father disturbs the peace, my mother keeps it. Every morning she goes to the office. She works for the state of Nevada, in her sensible pantsuit, and every night she comes home at 6, bone-tired, not uttering one word of complaint. With her last speck of energy, she cooks dinner. Then she lies down with her pets and a book, or her favorite, a jigsaw puzzle. Only every great once in a while does she lose her temper, and when she does, it's epic. One time my father made a remark about the house being unclean. My mother walked to the cupboard, took out 2 boxes of cereal, and waved them around her head like flags, spraying cornflakes and Cheerios everywhere. She yelled, "You want the house clean? Clean it yourself!" Moments later, she was calmly working on a jigsaw puzzle. She particularly loves Norman Rockwell puzzles. There is always some half-assembled scene of idyllic family life spread across the kitchen table. I can't imagine the pleasure my mother takes in jigsaw puzzles. All that fractured disorder, all that chaos. How can that be relaxing? It makes me think my mother and I are complete opposites. And yet, anything soft in me, any love or compassion I have for people, must come from her. Lying against her, letting her continue to stroke my hair, I think there is so much about her that I can't understand, and it all seems to flow from her choice of a husband. I ask how she ever ended up with a guy like my father in the first place. She gives a short, weary laugh. "It was a long time ago," she says, "back in Chicago. A friend of a friend told your father, 'You should meet Betty Dudley. She's just your type.' and vice versa. So your father phoned me one night at the girls' club where I was renting a furnished room. We talked a long, long time, and your father seemed sweet.
Sweet?
I know, but he did. So I agreed to meet him. He showed up the next day in a spiffy new Volkswagen. He drove me around town, no place in particular, just round and round, telling me his story. Then we stopped to get something to eat, and I told him my story. My mother told my father about growing up in Danville, Illinois, 170 miles from Chicago, the same small town where Gene Hackman and Donald O'Connor and Dick Van Dyke grew up. She told him about being a twin. She told him about her father, a crotchety English teacher, a stickler for proper English. My father, with his broken English, must have cringed. More likely, he didn't hear. I imagine my father not capable of listening to my mother on their first date. He would have been too mesmerized by her flaming auburn hair and bright blue eyes. I've seen pictures. My mother was a rare beauty. I wonder if he liked her hair best because it was the color of a clay tennis court. Or was it her height? She's several inches taller than he. I can imagine him perceiving that as a challenge. My mother says it took 8 blissful weeks for my father to convince her that they should combine their stories. They ran away from her crotchety father and her twin sister and eloped. Then they kept running. My father drove my mother clear out to Los Angeles, and when they had trouble finding jobs there, he drove her across the desert to a new gambling boomtown. My mother landed her job with the state government, and my father caught on at the Tropicana Hotel, giving tennis lessons. It didn't pay much, so he got a second job waiting tables at the Landmark Hotel. Then he got a job as a captain at the MGM Grand Casino, which kept him so busy he dropped the other two jobs. Over their first 10 years of marriage, my parents had 3 kids. Then, in 1969, my mother went to the hospital with ominous stomach pains. "Need to do a hysterectomy," the doctor said. But a second round of tests showed she was pregnant, with me. I was born on April 29, 1970, at Sunrise Hospital, 2 miles from the Strip. My father named me Andre Kirk Agassi, after his bosses at the casino. I asked my mother why my father named me after his bosses. Were they friends? Did he admire them? Did he owe them money? She doesn't know, and it's not the kind of question you can ask my father directly. You can't ask my father anything directly. So I file it away with all the other things I don't know about my parents, permanently missing pieces in the jigsaw puzzle that is me. My father works hard, puts in long hours on the night shift at the casino, but tennis is his life, his reason for getting out of bed. No matter where you sit in the house, you see scattered evidence of his obsession. Aside from the backyard court and the dragon, there is my father's laboratory, also known as the kitchen. My father's stringing machine and tools take up half the kitchen table. My mother's latest Norman Rockwell takes up the other half, 2 obsessions vying for 1 busy room. On the kitchen counter stand several stacks of rackets, many sawed in half so my father can study their guts. He wants to know everything about tennis, everything, which means dissecting its various parts. He's forever conducting experiments on this or that piece of equipment. Lately, for instance, he's been using old tennis balls to extend the lives of our shoes. When the rubber starts to wear down, my father cuts a tennis ball in half and puts 1 half on each toe. I tell Philly, "It's not bad enough that we live in a tennis laboratory. Now we have to wear tennis balls on our feet?" I wonder why my father loves tennis. Yet another question I can't ask him directly. Still, he drops clues. He talks sometimes about the beauty of the game, its perfect balance of power and strategy. Despite his imperfect life, Or maybe because of it, my father craves perfection. Geometry and mathematics are as close to perfection as human beings can get, he says. And tennis is all about angles and numbers. My father lies in bed and sees a court on the ceiling. He says he can actually see it there, and on that ceiling court, he plays countless imaginary matches. It's a wonder he has any energy when he goes to work. As a casino captain, it's my father's job to seat people at the shows. Right this way, Mr. Johnson. Nice to see you again, Miss Jones. The MGM pays him a small salary. The rest he earns in tips. We live on tips, which makes life unpredictable. Some nights, my father comes home with his pockets bulging with cash. Other nights, his pockets are perfectly flat. Whatever he pulls from his pockets, no matter how little, gets carefully counted and stacked, then stashed in the family safe. It's nerve-wracking, never knowing how much Pops is going to be able to tuck in the safe. My father loves money, makes no apologies for loving it. And he says there's good money to be made in tennis. Clearly, this is one big part of his love for tennis. It's the shortest route he can see to the American dream. He takes me to the Alan King Tennis Classic, and we watch a beautiful woman dressed as Cleopatra being carried onto center court by four half-naked muscle men in togas, followed by a man dressed as Caesar pushing a wheelbarrow full of silver dollars. First prize for the winner of the tournament. My father stares at the silvery haze sparkling in that Vegas sun and looks drunk. He wants that. He wants me to have that. Soon after that fateful day, when I'm almost 9 years old, he finagles me a job as a ball boy for the Alan King tournament. But I don't give a damn about silver dollars. I want a mini Cleopatra. Her name is Wendy. She's one of the ball girls, about my age, a vision in her blue uniform. I love her instantly, with all my heart and part of my spleen. I lie awake at night, picturing her on the ceiling. During matches, as Wendy and I dart past each other along the net, I shoot her a smile, try to get her to give me a smile in return. Between matches, I buy her Cokes and sit with her, trying to impress her with my knowledge of tennis. The Alan King tournament attracts big-time players, and my father cajoles most of them into hitting a few balls with me. Some are more willing than others. Borg acts as if there's nowhere else he'd rather be. Connors clearly wants to say no, but can't, because my father is his stringer. Ily Nastasi tries to say no, but my father pretends to be deaf. A champion of Wimbledon and the French Open, ranked number one in the world, Nastasi has other places he'd rather be, but he quickly discovers that refusing my father is next to impossible. The man is relentless. As Nastasi and I hit, Wendy watches from the net post. I'm nervous. Nastasi is visibly bored, until he spots Wendy.
"Hey," he says. "Is this your girlfriend, Snoopy? Is this pretty thing over here your sweetheart?"
I stop. I glare at Nastasi. I want to punch this big, stupid Romanian in the nose, even though he's got 2 feet and 100 pounds on me. Bad enough that he calls me Snoopy, but then he dares to mention Wendy in such a disrespectful way. A crowd has gathered, 200 people at least. Nastasi begins playing to the crowd, calling me Snoopy again and again, teasing me about Wendy, and I thought my father was relentless. At the very least, I wish I had the courage to say, "Mr. Nastasi, you're embarrassing me. Please stop." But all I can do is keep hitting harder, hit harder. Then Nastasi makes yet another wisecrack about Wendy, and that's it. I can't take any more. I drop my racket and walk off the court. Up yours, Nastasi. My father stares, open-mouthed. He's not angry, he's not embarrassed. He's incapable of embarrassment, and he recognizes his own genes when he sees them in action. I don't know that I've ever seen him prouder. Besides the occasional exhibition with a top-ranked player, my public matches are mostly hustle jobs. I have a slick routine to lure in the suckers. First, I pick a highly visible court, where I play by myself, knocking the ball all over the place. Second, when some cocky teenager or drunken guest strolls by, I invite them to play. Third, I let them beat me, soundly. Finally, in my most pitiful voice, I ask if they'd like to play for $1, maybe $5. Before they know what's happening, I'm serving for match point and $20, enough to keep Wendy and Cokes for a month. Philly taught me how to do it. He gives tennis lessons and often hustles his students, plays them for the price of the lesson, then double or nothing. But Andre, he says, with your size and youth, you should be raking in the dough. He helps me develop and rehearse the routine. Now and then, it occurs to me that I only think I'm hustling, that people are happy to shell out for the show. Later, they can brag to their friends that they saw a 9-year-old tennis freak who never misses. I don't tell my father about my side business. Not that he'd think it was wrong. He loves a good hustle. I just don't feel like talking to my father about tennis any more than is absolutely necessary. Then my father stumbles into his own hustle. It happens at Cambridge. As we walk in one day, my father points to a man talking with Mr. Fong. "That's Jim Brown," my father whispers to me. "Greatest football player of all time." He's an enormous block of muscle, wearing tennis whites and tube socks. I've seen him before at Cambridge. When he's not playing tennis for money, he's playing backgammon or shooting craps, also for money. Like my father, Mr. Brown talks a lot about money. At this moment, he's complaining to Mr. Fong about a money match that fell through. He was supposed to play a guy, and the guy didn't show. Mr. Brown is taking it out on Mr. Fong. "I came to play," Mr. Brown is saying, "and I want to play." My father steps forward. "You looking for a game?" "Yeah." "My son Andre will play you." Mr. Brown looks at me, then back at my father. "I ain't playing no 8-year-old boy." "9." "9? Ooh, well, I didn't realize." Mr. Brown laughs. A few men within earshot laugh too. I can tell that Mr. Brown doesn't take my father seriously. Big mistake. Just ask that trucker lying in the road. I close my eyes and see him, the rain pelting his face. "Look," Mr. Brown says, "I don't play for fun, okay? I play for money." "My son will play you for money." I feel a bead of sweat start down my armpit. "Yeah, how much?" My father laughs and says, "I'll bet you my fucking house." "I don't need your house," Mr. Brown says. "I got a house. Let's say $10,000. "Done," my father says. I walk toward the court. "Slow down," Mr. Brown says. "I need to see some money up front." "I'll go home and get it," my father says. "I'll be right back." My father hurries out the door. I sit in a chair and picture him opening the safe and pulling out stacks of money. All those tips I've seen him count through the years, all those nights of hard work. Now he's going to let it ride on me. I feel a heaviness in the center of my chest. I'm proud, of course, to think my father has such faith in me, but mainly I'm scared. What happens to me, to my father, to my mother and my siblings, not to mention Grandma and Uncle Isar, if I lose? I've played under this kind of pressure before, when my father, without warning, has chosen an opponent and ordered me to beat him. But it's always been another kid, and there's never been money involved. It usually happens in the middle of the afternoon. My father will wake me from a nap and yell, "Grab your racket. There's someone here you need to beat." It never occurs to him that I'm taking a nap because I'm exhausted from a morning playing the dragon, that 9-year-olds don't often take naps. Rubbing the sleep from my eyes, I'll go outside and see some strange kid, some prodigy from Florida or California who happens to be in town. They're always older and bigger, like that punk who just moved to Vegas and heard about me and rang our doorbell. He had a white rosin yawl and a head like a pumpkin. He was at least 3 years older than I, and he smirked as I walked out of the house because I was so small. Even after I beat him, even after I wiped that smirk off his face, it took hours for me to calm down, to shed the feeling that I'd just run along a tightrope stretched across Hoover Dam. This thing with Mr. Brown, however, is different, and not just because my family's life savings are riding on the outcome. Mr. Brown disrespected my father, and my father can't knock him out. He needs me to do it. So this match will be about more than money. It will be about respect and manhood and honor against the greatest football player of all time. I'd rather play in the final of Wimbledon against Nastasi with Wendy as the ball girl. Slowly, I become aware that Mr. Brown is watching me, staring. He walks over and introduces himself, shakes my hand. His hand is one big callus. He asks how long I've been playing, how many matches I've won, how many I've lost. I never lose, I say quietly. His eyes narrow. Mr. Fong pulls Mr. Brown aside and says, "Don't do this, Jim."
"Guy's asking for it," Mr. Brown whispers.
"Fool and his money."
"You don't understand," Mr. Fong says. "You are going to lose, Jim."
"What the hell are you? He's a kid."
"That's not just any kid."
"You must be crazy."
"Look, Jim, I like having you come here. You're a friend, and it's good for business to have you at my club. But when you lose 10 grand to this kid, you'll be sore, and you might stop coming around."
Mr. Brown turns to look me up and down as if he must have missed something the first time. He walks back toward me and starts firing questions.
"How much do you play?"
"Every day."
"No, how long do you play at one time? An hour? Couple of hours?"
I see what he's doing. He wants to know how fast I get tired. He's trying to size me up, game planning for me. My father's back. He's got a fistful of hundreds. He waves it in the air. Suddenly, Mr. Brown has had a change of heart.
"Here's what we'll do," Mr. Brown tells my father. "We'll play 2 sets, then decide how much to bet on the third."
"Whatever you say." We play on court 7, just inside the door. A crowd has gathered, and they cheer themselves hoarse as I win the first set 6-3. Mr. Brown shakes his head. He talks to himself. He bangs his racket on the ground. He's not happy, which makes 2 of us. Not only am I thinking in direct violation of my father's cardinal rule, but my head is spinning. I feel as if I might have to stop playing at any moment because I need to throw up. Still, I win the second set 6-3. Now Mr. Brown is furious. He drops to one knee, laces his sneakers. My father approaches him.
"So, 10 grand?
"Nah," Mr. Brown says.
"Why don't we just bet $500?
"Whatever you say." My body relaxes. My mind grows quiet. I want to dance along the baseline, knowing I won't have to play for $10,000. I can swing freely now, without thinking about consequences, without thinking at all. Mr. Brown, meanwhile, is thinking more, playing a less relaxed game. He's suddenly junking, drop-shotting, lofting lobs, angling the ball at the corners, trying backspin and sidespin and all sorts of trickery. He's also trying to run me back and forth, wear me out. but I'm so relieved not to be playing for the entire contents of my father's safe that I can't be worn out, and I can't miss. I beat Mr. Brown 6-2. Sweat running down his face, he pulls a wad from his pocket and counts 5 crisp hundreds. He hands them to my father, then turns to me.
Great game, son.
He shakes my hand. His calluses feel rougher, thanks to me. He asks what my goals are, my dreams. I start to answer, but my father jumps in.
He's going to be number one in the world. I wouldn't bet against him,
Mr. Brown says. Not long after beating Mr. Brown, I play a practice match against my father at Caesar's. I'm up 5-2, serving for the match. I've never beaten my father, and he looks as if he's about to lose much more than $10,000. Suddenly, he walks off the court.
Get your stuff, he says. Let's go.
He won't finish. He'd rather sneak away than lose to his son. Deep down, I know it's the last time we'll ever play. Packing my bag, zipping the cover on my racket, I feel a thrill greater than anything I felt after beating Mr. Brown. This is the sweetest win of my life, and it will be hard to top. I'll take this win over a wheelbarrow full of silver dollars and Uncle Isar's jewels thrown on top, because this is the win that made my father finally sneak away from me.